Tonight on PBS News Weekend, 5 years in, we check in on the Rohingya refugee crisis as more displaced people make the desperate journey to start a new life.
They're people who nobody seems to want.
Then, with the killings of journalists on the rise, we look at why reporting is becoming more dangerous in some parts of the world, and the youth mental health crisis in America, and efforts one state is making to increase access to care. Good evening, I'm John Yang. Today in Israel, funerals began for the seven victims of Friday's mass shooting outside an East Jerusalem synagogue, the deadliest attack on Israelis in nearly 15 years. Mourners wept and comforted grieving relatives. The shooting punctuated a month of increased violence between Israelis and Palestinians. This morning, Israeli police and soldiers welded shut the doors to the home of the Palestinian man identified as the shooter. He was killed by police as he tried to flee the scene of the attack. It's part of Benjamin Netanyahu's response. In a cabinet meeting, the prime minister also vowed to strengthen Israeli settlements in the West Bank, but offered no details. It's against this backdrop that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who was in Egypt today, begins a two-day visit on Monday to Jerusalem and the West Bank. A couple of sports notes this Sunday. Novak Djokovic won the Australian Open Men's Singles Championship today for a record 10th time. It was his 22nd Grand Slam title. That ties him with Rafael Nadal for the men's record. Only two tennis players have more, Serena Williams with 23 and Australia's Margaret Court with 24. And Buffalo Bills safety Damar Hamlin spoke publicly for the first time since he went into cardiac arrest during a game earlier this month. In a video posted on social media last night, Hamlin thanked those who cared for him and cared about him and promised to use his second chance at life to give back.
Well, I'm so thankful to everybody. I know that it isn't enough just to be thankful. This is just the beginning of the impact that I wanted to have on the world. I couldn't do this without any of the support and the love, and I can't wait to continue to take y'all on this journey with me.
Hamlin said he's come to peace with what happened to him and thanked players and fans across the league for putting humanity above team loyalty. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the youth mental health crisis plaguing America. And blind soccer players get a shot at playing for the United States on the global stage.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
It's been 5 years since hundreds of thousands of Rohingya were driven out of Myanmar, fleeing the brutality of government security forces. Most went to camps in neighboring Bangladesh, and now a growing number of them have been setting out to open sea in hopes of getting to Malaysia or Indonesia, where they believe they can live more freely. The United Nations estimates the number of Rohingya making that desperate journey went up fivefold last year. At least 348 people died or went missing attempting the trip, making it one of the deadliest years for Rohingya refugees since 2014. They spent weeks adrift in a rickety wooden boat, finally coming ashore in Aceh, Indonesia's northernmost province. Since November, hundreds of refugees have made landfall in Indonesia, many of them badly needing medical attention.
After 5 days, our boat began breaking down. We had no food or water.
19-year-old Fatima bin Ismail arrived last month.
Five men jumped because they couldn't handle the hunger. Then after 12 days, water started coming into the boat, and more people jumped because they feared the boat would sink in the ocean. There were bodies floating in the water here and there. We couldn't do anything.
23-year-old Mohammed Furos fled from Myanmar to Bangladesh. He left his family in an overcrowded Bangladeshi refugee camp after getting death threats over his job as a teacher.
They burned down our houses. They looted our properties. They killed our innocent father and sister and mother and brother. They raped our sister and mother in front of us, in front of everything. We don't have any way.
In 2017, roughly 700,000 Rohingya, mostly Muslims, were forced from Buddhist-majority Myanmar. Myanmar security forces have been accused of mass rapes, killings, and burning thousands of Rohingya homes. Most of the now stateless Rohingya are languishing in Bangladesh, one of the world's poorest countries. They live in crowded camps set up when their exodus from Myanmar began and intended only to be temporary. Like most Rohingya, Firoz would like to go back to his homeland, but fears what would await him there.
Everyone is trying to repatriate, even trying to go to our motherland, go back to our motherland with a full citizenship, because we don't have place.
Phil Robertson is the deputy director of the Asia division of Human Rights Watch.
These Rohingya, they want to go home, but they want to return in dignity, with rights. They want their land back. They want to be protected. There has to be a recognition that these people are going to continue to come out until there's a solution for the problems that exist in Myanmar and in Bangladesh.
Last week, the Indonesian government called for a regional effort to address the crisis of refugees stranded at sea. Earlier, I spoke with Poppy McPherson, a Reuters correspondent based in Bangkok. She's covered the Rohingya crisis for nearly a decade. I asked her why so many more people are making this dangerous journey now.
The situations for Rohingya, both in Myanmar, where they're from, and the refugee camps in Bangladesh have considerably deteriorated in the past kind of couple of years. I've not heard people be so despondent and so hopeless, partly because of the length of time. You know, I think a lot of people didn't think that they would be stuck in these camps for so long, but also because of the increased restrictions that the Bangladesh authorities are putting on the camps. People feel that their lives are just shrinking. There's no opportunity for work. There's not any real opportunities for education in the camps. So especially young people, the option that seems available to them is really to get out. The other thing we've seen is a rise in violence and security issues in the camps. There's abductions, killings going on, some of which seems to be linked to the drug trade.
The deteriorating conditions in these camps, the new restrictions, does this reflect the Bangladeshi attitude toward Rohingya refugees?
In the beginning, there was a huge outpouring of support and sympathy for the Rohingya. Many Bangladeshis in the local area really welcomed people. But now it's been 5 years, and there's no sign that the Rohingya are going to be going back to Myanmar, as the conditions for them there haven't improved. And Bangladesh is also under some pressure domestically. The community has started to turn against the Rohingya. So it's become a political issue inside Bangladesh.
The people who are setting out to sea, to flee these camps in Bangladesh, what are their lives like in Indonesia and Malaysia? What are the attitudes toward them in Indonesia and Malaysia?
Well, for a while, the lives of Rohingya living in Malaysia were better. I mean, better than in Bangladesh refugee camps or in Myanmar, where they're facing such extreme persecution and violence. But Malaysia has changed its stance and is taking a much more hostile attitude towards Rohingya. In Indonesia, the fishermen often save boats that are in distress, and they're really the only community that has been doing that. The rest of the other estates in the region have not. Once Rohingya get into Indonesia and Malaysia, the conditions are better. They might be able to find work if they're lucky, but they may also face persecution there as well. Neither Indonesia or Malaysia are signatories to the UN Refugee Convention. They're not guaranteed recognition as refugees.
What's the role of smugglers, of human smugglers in this? And also, is there any aspect of human trafficking in this?
I've spoken to people who've said that they've been forced to get on the boats, that someone's approached them in a market and basically forced them on board. There's also a lot of women and girls on the boats, some of them going for marriage in Malaysia, and the not sure how voluntary all of that is.
You spoke about conditions in Myanmar not improving. Is there any glimmer of hope that conditions would improve to the point where some of the refugees could return safely?
The big problem is that the military, who were the ones that actually drove out the Rohingya, are now in full control of the country since the military coup in 2021. The Burmese military regard the Rohingya with deep-seated racism, and they regard them as foreigners who don't deserve to be living in Myanmar. The likelihood of them reversing that policy is slim.
Is there any place for them to go?
I mean, that's it. There is nowhere for them to go. It's a situation of desperation, that they're people who nobody seems to want. You know, Myanmar's rejected them. Bangladesh is rejecting them. The life that they're allowed to live in Bangladesh is a life that nobody would want, a life of no opportunity, of confinement. Taking to the sea in these dangerous voyages is the best of many bad options.
Poppy McPherson of Reuters, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says 2022 was one of the deadliest on record for journalists around the world. Killings increased by nearly 50% from the previous year. Lisa Desjardins has more on the increasingly dangerous environment for journalists worldwide.
Over the past 5 years, 289 journalists have been killed worldwide, many in retaliation for the work they were doing. Last year, 67 journalists were killed, the highest number in a single year since 2018. More than half of those deaths happened in just three countries. In Ukraine, 15 died covering Russia's brutal war there. Mexico and Haiti saw the sharpest rise in killings. 30 journalists were killed in Latin America alone, nearly half of all journalists killed last year. Joining us now to talk about this is Jody Ginsberg, president at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Jody, the first question is why? Why do you think we're seeing this increase in journalists' death and killings?
There's a couple of reasons. As you mentioned, the highest number of killings was in Ukraine, as you would expect any kind of international conflict. But increasingly, we're seeing journalists killed outside of war zones. As you said, nearly half the deaths that we documented last year were in the Latin America region, which is officially not in any conflict. And what that's indicative of is this global political instability we're seeing, increased lawlessness and a decline in democracy worldwide. There was one killing of a journalist here in the United States last year.
Can you talk more about that and more about this hemisphere, including Mexico and Haiti?
Well, in Latin America, for example, we saw 30 journalist killings out of the 67 last year. The majority of those are in Mexico, where we've seen a real uptick in violence generally. We see journalists killed for covering corruption, particularly in local politics. Local journalists are incredibly vulnerable. They often don't have the protections afforded to them by working for a big national media outlet. Covering protests can be fatal. We're seeing more and more political protests, of course, as people are discontented from the global economy and other issues. So that's an area of concern. In Haiti, we've seen effectively a complete collapse of any authority. People are covering gang warfare, but it's all part of a bigger pattern of increased lawlessness in the region.
Of course, killings are the thing that people pay attention to, but also the number of imprisonments of journalists is on the rise, other forms of harassment, including online harassment. Can you talk about why you think that is on the rise and who is using that as a tool to try and stifle journalists?
That's true. Last year was a record number for imprisoned journalists worldwide, over 350 journalists in prison at the end of November, December the 1st last year. In part, that's also because we're seeing increased use of legal means to imprison journalists to prevent them covering corruption. When you think about it, the killings and the imprisonments of journalists are just the tip of the iceberg. They're indicative of a much broader pattern of a decline in press freedom more generally. We see thousands of journalists harassed online every day, and unfortunately, often that turns into offline real-world violence, physical threats against journalists, and that's something we're seeing more and more.
Have you been able to tell if that is, in fact, stifling coverage, stifling the ability of information to get out?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason people go after journalists is because they want to silence them. They want to stop the story getting out, and that's exactly what happens. It's a deterrent. It stops other journalists from reporting on the issue, and in some areas, we have essentially complete information black holes in places like Mexico, where people cannot talk about the violence, the corruption going on in their local areas. And that's incredibly dangerous for ordinary people who rely on that kind of information and that kind of reporting from journalists.
So then this leads back to, I think, the thread that you're weaving throughout this, which is about democracy and crisis around the world or threats to democracy. How do you connect that to what's happening to the threats for journalists?
Well, the way I would connect it is this. You know, we've simultaneously seen this decline in democracy is accompanied by an undermining of democratic norms. And that includes this idea that journalists are the enemy, that they are something not to be trusted. And we've seen that repeatedly used as a refrain by those in power, who of course would use that argument because they don't want their affairs looked into. But that narrative unfortunately seeps through into the general population, who increasingly grow to distrust journalists, see them as representatives of one political side or other. And so that sort of general narrative helps to undermine the credibility of journalism, and that's what helps contribute to this increasing lack of safety for journalists worldwide.
Jody Ginsburg with the Committee to Protect Journalists, very sobering and important work. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Depression and anxiety among adolescents was already at crisis levels before the pandemic, but it surged amid the isolation, disruption, and hardship of COVID. Earlier this month, William Brangham traveled to Oregon to find why it ranks as one of the worst states for youth mental health illness and what's being done to help those in need. His reporting is part of our new series, Early Warnings, America's Youth Mental Health Crisis. William, thanks so much for joining us today. Why Oregon? Why did you go to Oregon?
Well, there's an organization called Mental Health America, and every year they put out an annual survey ranking how states provide care to mental illness and how severe the crisis is. And Oregon, unfortunately, ranks dead last in the country as far as young people who are struggling with their mental illness and their access to care. It's the highest rate of young people in this country with one serious depressive episode. It is the third highest number of children with substance abuse disorders and ranks 42nd in the country for those children with those depressive episodes not getting care. And so there are a bunch of reasons why this happened. A recent state audit looked at several different factors, staffing shortages, poor data, and just an overall lack of beds. We, in fact, in our reporting, found that in the entire state, there are only 40 beds for the most acute children who need this kind of care. And there's also this issue of Oregon being a rural state. I mean, there are several major cities, and the majority of people live in those cities. But a lot of the state lives in places where it's hours to care. And then mental health officials tell us once they discharge those people, they're going back to communities where there may not be a single psychiatrist in town to help them.
This must put tremendous burden and pressure on the families. What sorts of stories did you hear?
We heard so many different parents and families talking about this struggle. One mother, whose name is Laura, we didn't end up filming with her, but she told us a harrowing story. She adopted three children from within her own family. Each of those children had suffered terrible, all manner of abuse. Her 15-year-old daughter one day said to her, "I'm thinking about killing myself. I tried to drown myself in the tub last night." And so Laura goes on this quest to instantly try to find care for her. And every single doctor and psychiatrist she called said, almost as a matter of course, "We are months out before we can take care of you." And Laura was in a bit of a panic. This is a woman who works at a hospital as an administrator. She's someone who family members and friends would call her and help them troubleshoot health insurance issues, and she couldn't even get care. She described this as feeling like a murderer had taken her child. And every moment of every day, she thought, "Is my daughter going to die? Is she going to not come home today?" And we heard a very similar set of stories. She eventually did get care, but it was a long, hard road. And she is just one of tens of thousands of families and parents.
There was a bright spot in your reporting. You found a program that does show hope.
That's right. This is an organization called Youthline, and it is a call-in line for teenagers who are in crisis. But the people who are answering those phones or texts or chats are other teenagers themselves. And The theory behind this is, and there's some evidence backing this up, is that teenagers who are struggling are much more likely to talk to other teenagers than, no offense, to people like you and me. And the idea being, these kids will answer those calls, they will answer those chats, albeit with a good deal of training. But this organization has seen an incredible spike in growth from a few thousand calls per year to now tens of thousands of calls per year. And so Youthline is trying to grow this model and to diversify their base of volunteers who are working for them, go into Native reservations, and try to make this program go national in the near future.
William Brangham, thank you very much for sharing your reporting.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
Last fall, the USA Blind Soccer National Team held its first ever tryouts for players with visual impairments. San Diego member station KPBS reports the team has set their hopes on competing in the 2028 Paralympic Games.
I have athletes throughout my family, and I was never able to really partake when I was a kid or participate because I was blind. And so when I discovered blind sports, I fell in love. And I fell in love the moment I stepped onto a soccer pitch.
Ready, Cody?
Right.
Yeah.
Alvaro first. Boy.
There are four field players on each team. The ball has rattles in the lining of it.
Run! Shoot! Shoot!
And you are required to say the word voy if you are attacking the ball. I think it's either Spanish or Portuguese for I am coming.
Keep going. Turn right. Good. Drive.
Communication is vital to blind soccer. It's the only way we could really be out here and play a game without it ending up in just everyone being injured. So the goalie is the only person on the field who is sighted. The goalie has perfect vision, I hope, and everyone else wears, as you can probably see now, eye shades that completely block out all light.
Be sharp. Yep. The ball is probably 2-3 times heavier than a regular size 5 soccer ball. It's a little smaller, and you know, the beads inside of it, you know, trying to kick the ball, it's different.
Yep.
Soccer is a sport that we all know, right, and love. So the blind athletes are excited to kind of get out here and try something new. It's also a lot more of a physical sport within the blind sport world. So they have to work on a lot of different skills, from communication to orientation, their ball skills. It's a little bit more physical. But I think that's what makes the game so exciting and great.
If the defender wins it, I just want you to dribble straight past that line and we will communicate with you. I want to see what you do after. So if the defender wins it, right, yep, we are countering to that line. Defenders and attackers, you're going to stay in your line for a given amount of time.
To be able to be out here on a 40 by 20 meter field, running as fast as I can, as hard as I can, fighting for a ball, taking shots, it opened up so many dreams.
Shoot!
To represent my nation, my country, to put on a jersey with USA behind on the back of it is just incredible. And then to think of all the blind people who are sitting at home right now thinking they can't do this, they can't do something as simple as crossing a street, and I'm out here trying to represent them, trying to spread this message that yes, you can do those things, and if you do them well enough, you can one day put on this jersey too.
USA!
Now online, a look at an Oklahoma artist's efforts to piece back together a vandalized sculpture of a famed Native American ballerina. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.